We're talking about Wisconsin's pollution credit trading system here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Earlier this month, the state Senate approved a bill that's meant to boost our state's pollution credit trading system, making it better, making it easier for large-scale polluters to trade credits with farmers. We're looking at the system and what it would mean for water quality with your insights along the way. 800-642-1234. Are you a farmer? Have you exceeded water pollution limits? Or are you below pollution limits? Have you made extra income because of the credit trading system? Do you want to be part of this credit trading system and learn more? Call in 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. Kevin Kirsch is the Department of Natural Resources Water Resources Engineer. Kevin, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
All right, so we need a primer here. What are water pollution credits? How does this trading system work?
Okay, so water pollution credits are, as you indicated, they're developed by facilities that go below the requirement that they have for the reduction of pollutants. And those excess credits or excess reduction that they have is available for sale to other facilities that have not met the requirements. And these trades can occur between point sources, which are like wastewater treatment plants and industrial facilities, or they can occur between agricultural sources and wastewater treatment plants.
Okay, so we're going to get into these point sources in just a moment, but apparently this trading system has been up and running in Wisconsin for decades. How is it going?
So our system really got up and going in 2010. And right now we have about 742 permitted wastewater facilities. And of those, 40 so far have opted to engage in water quality trading. So they have found that water quality trading is the most economic way for them to meet their limits.
To be part of this credit trading system, you have to have a permit. Is that right?
So correct. So like I said, we have about 742 facilities that are permitted. And facilities receive a permit so that they can discharge the surface waters. The permits are issued in five-year increments and place limits on how much of that pollutant can be discharged. And they also set the monitoring and compliance requirements for that facility.
So who qualifies for these permits, and what about the cost?
So anyone who discharges one of the pollutants of concern is issued a permit. As far as the cost, there's a nominal fee on the permit side. I think the cost and what drives the water quality trading is the potential compliance costs. And so most of the trading in Wisconsin has been driven by our phosphorus water quality criteria, which were adopted in 2010. And those criteria reflect the allowable phosphorus concentrations in streams and lakes that allow attainment of our recreational use through, for example, minimizing algal blooms and supporting aquatic life.
So phosphorus, very harmful. Do you find that this trading system is going to impact the issue around phosphorus in our waterways?
So potentially, so the current trading system we have, like I indicate, we've had 40 facilities choose to engage in water quality trading so far for phosphorus. So when this bill was, when the water quality criteria was adopted in 2010, facilities were given compliance schedules for their phosphorus, and most facilities are required to be in compliance between 2017 and 2024. So we're still relatively early in the process.
We're talking. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. So this clearinghouse bill creates basically an option for a third-party broker to act as a middleman between potential agricultural producers and potential buyers of credits. Up to this point, the 40 trades that have occurred, the wastewater treatment facilities have generally been working with the county land conservation offices, our county LCD offices. And those offices may have minimum resources or may not be able to assist point sources. And the watersheds that the wastewater facilities are looking to trade in may also cross multiple county lines. So this bill would provide that clearinghouse to aid facilities.
Yeah, it sounds like you need that middleman. You need that matchmaker so that you can figure out, you know, who's in and who's not and where those credits are available.
Generally the agricultural producers are not used to working with point sources and vice versa. So, the middleman can definitely help connect someone who has excess credits with someone who needs them.
We're talking about Wisconsin's pollution credit trading system. Kevin Hirsch is the Department of Natural Resources Water Resources Engineer. You can join in 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about Wisconsin's pollution credit system? Who do you think benefits? Who gets left behind? You can call in, email ideas at WPR.org. So you've been talking about these sources. Explain for us, what are the sources that we're looking at here?
Okay, yeah. So the sources are divided into two main sources, the point sources and the non-point sources. So point sources refer to wastewater dischargers, which include wastewater treatment plants and industrial and food processing facilities. And the sources of phosphorus in the wastewater treatment plants are the result of the treatment of human waste at those facilities. And then the industrial and food processing, phosphorus can stem from various processes used at those facilities. And then for the agricultural sources, the non-point sources, most of the phosphorus comes from fertilizer and manure.
So how does the state keep track of this water pollution, and how do officials figure out who's responsible for the pollution when it occurs, when it happens?
So for the point sources, the permits have the monitoring requirements.
Okay.
So you're able to see how much phosphorus is being discharged. They have a effluent limit, a maximum amount that they can discharge. And so you can compare those two and see, are they in compliance? Are they below what they need to discharge, or do they need credits? On the agricultural side, it becomes a little bit more complicated. But we've been lucky through partnerships with UW-Mass and Department of Ag, NRCS. We've developed a series of models and tools that are based on extensive monitoring data, but they allow us to run what-ifs on agricultural fields to see what sort of practices can be put in, what sort of reduction in phosphorus you would get off those fields, and then therefore what kind of credits would be available.
So, Kevin, are credit systems like Wisconsin's reducing water pollution? Is there proof? Is there tracking?
So there is tracking. Everything is tracked through the permit. And in the Wisconsin state statutes that oversee the Wisconsin trading program, a trade has to result in a net reduction of pollution over an absence of a trade. So a trade does result in an improvement in water quality through the reduction of phosphorus.
Well, Kevin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. And if your listeners have any additional questions, they can visit the DNR website and just on the search box, type in water quality trading, and it'll take you to our main website that has a lot of detailed information.
And we'll have a link on our site as well, WPR.org, on the morning show page. Kevin Kirsch is the Department of Natural Resources Water Resources Engineer. Up next, a public health expert helps us understand barriers to accessing immunization in Wisconsin. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about vaccinations here on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. When vaccination rates plummet, measles outbreaks rise. And measles is very contagious. Since the beginning of the year, hundreds of cases have been reported in a multi-state outbreak. In some parts of Wisconsin, we're seeing measles vaccination rates going down. Some major metro areas around the U.S. are also seeing the same thing. Do you face barriers to getting your kids vaccinated? Is it difficult for you to access health care for your children? And health care providers, how do you address families who are vaccine hesitant? Are you worried about vaccinating your children? Call in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Raj Naik is a pediatrician with Gundersen Health System in Onalaska, and his actual title is Childhood Immunization Champion. He's on the board for the Wisconsin chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Dr. Naik, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So we've seen these measles outbreaks. They've hit 26 states with the most cases reported in over 20 years. And state health officials said earlier this month that Wisconsin is at a high risk for an outbreak. What does that look like?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of reasons that a lot of states are at risk. But as immunization rates go down for specific diseases like measles, we become at risk for outbreaks of the disease, and with a highly contagious disease like measles, one that's very infectious, it only takes a little bit of a dip in the rates and one or two cases to cause a more widespread outbreak.
Because it is so contagious, is that right?
Absolutely. It's highly, highly contagious, so exposure to one individual can lead to many cases.
And we see that in some parts of Wisconsin, up to 30 or even 40% of residents haven't received the full MMR vaccine, the measles, mumps, and rubella. What parts of the state are particularly at risk? Are there pockets of vulnerability?
Yes, there are pockets of vulnerability, and we call those actually non-vaccination hotspots, areas in which the rates dip low enough where we're at risk for those diseases or infections coming back. And Wisconsin is amongst 18 of the states in this country which allow personal exemptions to vaccinations, which can lead to these hotspots. So a lot of the outbreaks that occur with vaccine-preventable diseases tend to follow these non-vaccination hotspots. And so we have pockets of these areas throughout our state.
And Vernon County is one of those hotspots, has Wisconsin's highest rate of two-year-olds without the measles vaccine. What do we know there?
Yeah, there's Vernon County. It's close to where I work and within our catchment area, and there's a population of people for personal reasons there that have chosen not to vaccinate, and so certainly that specific county is at high risk for a potential outbreak.
So how much does it matter what percentage of a community or a city is vaccinated? Why does that percentage matter so much?
Well, it matters a lot because of something called herd immunity. Herd immunity is the concept that immunizing a majority of people protects us all by keeping disease rates at low levels or even nearly eradicated. But when we have pockets of people that choose not to immunize, we lose that ability to have protection from the herd as a whole. And as we discussed earlier, it just takes, with some of these diseases, one case for it to spread amongst others. It's also important to note that not all of the vaccines are 100% effective or that not all people can receive the vaccines. For measles in particular, if you have a condition in which your immune system doesn't work properly, you can't receive the vaccine. And furthermore, the vaccine doesn't work for children under the age of one, so we don't start giving it until age 1 year, which means all of these babies are susceptible to the disease. So in protecting entire populations, we depend not only on each of us doing our own immunizations, but we also depend on keeping the herd as a whole protected and free of disease.
We're talking about vaccinations and infectious disease outbreaks with pediatrician Raj Naik. He's with Gundersen Health System. You can join in at 800-642-1234 at any point in this discussion. Do you face barriers to getting your child vaccinated? Are there not clinics, perhaps, close to you that offer vaccines, or is it difficult for you to access health care for your child? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Naik, how did we get to this point? What keeps people from getting themselves or their child vaccinated?
Yes, I'm glad you brought this up, because we like to think about all of the common barriers to immunization so we can overcome them. And I like to group it into three major categories. The first is vaccine hesitancy, and you can subcategorize that a little bit further into patient and family hesitancy, and also sometimes some healthcare provider hesitancy. There are missed opportunities, which include some of the things you mentioned, like problems with accessing healthcare, but also failure to take the advantage of opportunities to immunize at every type of healthcare visit, lack of standardized immunization practices, or absence of alerts and reminders and recall systems to bring people back for their immunizations. And lastly, sometimes there's a lack of systematic quality improvement practices. In other words, you know, we need data and we need to track it, and we need to have systematic processes in place to make sure that entire populations are up to date on their vaccines. So those are the broad categories of barriers to immunizations, and it's important that we identify them so we can overcome those barriers.
And when you talk about systematic quality improvement, do you mean like catching things in a patient's electronic health record, for instance, that then sends off an alarm bell or a signal to get that patient in, to get them on track with their immunization schedule?
Absolutely. In the modern era where electronic medical records are being implemented and used, there are systems that can be used and put in place to identify these patients. Prior to the electronic medical records, and these had to be done manually by chart searches and identifying and then mailing things. But now with electronic medical record systems, there are ways to survey the systems and identify those patients and put into place automatic reminders and recalls so that we can get people back who are overdue for immunizations.
Let's bring in Pat now from Monona. Good morning, Pat.
Good morning. I'm calling. My mother, 94-year-old mother, just received a notice that she is due for her MMR vaccination. So we're wondering if how important it is for someone 94 years old who also had measles as a child, how important is it for her to receive the vaccination?
Thank you so much, Pat. Great question. Dr. Naik?
Yeah, for somebody that's had measles, it's not something that they need to do and go ahead and vaccinate. And people in that age range generally have had measles. But it is important if you're in an age range in which you have not had the actual disease, or you don't have proof of immunity and you only had one dose of the vaccine. Those are all people who would be good candidates to receive a second dose of the vaccine.
Pat, thanks so much for the call. Dr. Naik, what might make it difficult for somebody to access all the immunizations their child needs?
Yeah, there's a lot of important information about access to health care, and that's something that can be concerning in terms of disparities of health care for people that might be in certain areas or certain groups. And, you know, we're particularly concerned about those that might be uninsured or underinsured, or those who may live in areas that are socioeconomically disadvantaged. We know that there are some discrepancies in vaccine-preventable infections amongst those groups. And so it is important, obviously, for us to look at these areas and address these access issues to try to improve these disparities.
And when you talk disparities, one study found a roughly 20% disparity between people with private insurance plans and people with Medicaid when looking at on-schedule vaccination rates. What's going on there?
Yeah, and so what you're referring to is actually something that comes from health plan surveys looking at those with Medicaid versus those with traditional commercial insurance, and it's looking at a combination of 10 different vaccines. These are all of the early common childhood immunizations, including influenza vaccine, in addition to the traditional ones, and there certainly is a discrepancy, and I think it just points out the fact that if you're worried about housing and food, sometimes healthcare may take a back seat.
Talking with Gunderson Health System pediatrician Raj Naik, you can join in 800-642-1234. Are you concerned about vaccinating your child? What would reassure you? Or maybe you used to worry but changed your mind. Join in, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue this after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent, and we're looking at vaccination here in Wisconsin and the U.S. as we see deadly measles outbreaks around the country. And the outbreaks haven't touched us in Wisconsin yet. While most of the U.S. still has vaccination rates of 90% to 95%, that's adequate to prevent measles transmission, vaccine refusal has created these pockets of vulnerability that we've been talking about. And here's Dr. Nancy Messonnier. She's director of the National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases.
These outbreaks are really being fueled by misinformation and myth that is leading communities to be under-vaccinated.
Healthcare providers, how do you address families who are vaccine hesitant? What have you found is the best approach? Parents, do you face barriers in getting your child vaccinated? Let's talk about it. 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. And Gunderson Health System pediatrician Raj Naik stays with us. So, Raj, every child has access to vaccinations. The CDC's Vaccines for Children program has required states to include free vaccines for kids on Medicaid since 1993, for decades now. How has this program helped increase accessibility to vaccines? Has it?
It absolutely has. It's a really important program. And because of the importance of vaccines, this program was developed to make sure that all children, regardless of socioeconomic status, have the ability to receive vaccines. And so it's critically important to have this program in place. But as we mentioned earlier, unfortunately, there are still some barriers that exist, and that may be with accessing these vaccines that are provided for them. So it's a critically important program, but not always taken advantage of fully.
Some people have been calling for Wisconsin to have an immunization chief or an immunization champion to really hone in and focus on making sure that that children are vaccinated in this state. Does it need a type of czar approach, do you think?
That's a good question, there's certainly a number of people throughout the state, and there's committees at work throughout the state working to improve overall immunization rates. I'm not sure if having one person point of contact, a so-called czar, would be the difference or not. But what I do know is that there's a lot of work that needs to be done to systematically overcome the barriers that we discussed earlier to make sure that children are receiving these vaccines on time.
Why do children with private insurance have more access to vaccines? Do they have more access to providers than children under Medicaid?
I wouldn't say that they necessarily have more access or less access, but making sure that that they're following through with that access is certainly a concern. For example, if you live in an area in which the healthcare is a little further away from you, or if transportation to these areas is a problem, that's a potential barrier to accessing the care. And as I mentioned earlier, if you're more worried about putting food on the table or having a place to live, even though the vaccines are technically available to all, perhaps healthcare takes a back seat to those other concerns. So there's certainly concerns overall about discrepancies in accessing care, even though in theory it's available to all.
Let's go to the phones now at 800-642-1234. Bernie is joining us from Oakland. Hi, Bernie.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to point out that the coverage of vaccines is always that vaccines are good and that anybody who's opposed to vaccines is somehow ignorant or unscientific. There's an excellent movie called Vax, V-A-X-X-E-D. You can buy it for $20. The site is Vax, the movie. And it talks about a whistleblower at CDC that talks about the MMR vaccine and the dangers of this vaccine and how they were completely swept under the rug. And I truly believe that the mercury, the things in the vaccine that have caused damage to children, to adults, we're not getting an equal hearing in the public. We're getting you have to be ignorant, unscientific. There's a lot to this that needs to be talked about, but it seems the dialogue is always vaccines good, people that question them ignorant.
Bernie, thanks so much for bringing this to the table. Dr. Naik, what about those concerns with the safety over these vaccinations like MMR?
Yes, well, I appreciate the caller bringing up these issues because he expresses what a lot of people come to us with concerns about vaccine safety. And actually, unlike what the caller expresses in terms of the information being imbalanced with regards to the benefits of vaccine, that's not actually what goes on. And in fact, there's some of the anti-vaccine movement has learned to influence social media, including Facebook, to give some unbalanced information. They learned the algorithms, and recently the American Academy of Pediatrics lobbied Facebook to address this issue and try to make sure that we have balanced information provided. But in terms of vaccine safety in general, there's a lot of myths out there. There's a lot of some of which the caller expressed about vaccines. What you have to do is trust what science tells us. And with science, we don't have fixed beliefs. We follow what the data says and where it takes us. It's how progress is made scientifically. And although there's a lot of myths out there, there's a lot of stories, such as in the movie that the caller exposed. When you follow science, you make hypotheses, and if your hypothesis is supported, you go where the science takes you. If it's not supported, you reject it, and then you study another question. It's really how science is done, and the importance of that is that you don't have fixed beliefs. We can't decide before the data takes us somewhere. And I think it's really important that we learn to follow the science and trust people that know science, because there is so much misinformation out there. If we don't have someone that can help us sort through all of this information, it's difficult to know what to believe.
Bernie also brought up mercury. What do we know about mercury and vaccines?
Yeah, so this is one of the common safety concerns that people become hesitant about. This whole story started several years ago when we used to have a number of vaccines that had preservatives in it. One of the preservatives was called dimerosal, which is actually a mercury derivative, but it's not the type of mercury that's in the environment. Nonetheless, many years ago, There was a movement to get the mercury out of vaccines, not because it was shown to be toxic, but on theoretical grounds. And the amount that was in there was a tiny, tiny amount and never shown to be toxic at all. But that started the myth that whatever was in the vaccine was toxic, whereas it was never shown to be that. That being said, almost all the vaccines today are packaged in single dose vials. Mm-hmm. So there really isn't any of the thimerosal in there except for multi-dose flu vaccine. And the reason it's still in there is that in order to make something that's seasonal, that changes year to year, and to get it shipped all over the country, there's still a need for some multi-dose vials. That being said, there's also some thimerosal-free flu vaccines, and the amount that's in there is tiny, tiny, well below any amount that would be toxic. And remember that we're exposed to things like mercury in our environment. You eat fish, you eat other things. Thimerosal and mercury and other heavy metals come from the Earth's crust, and they seep into everything that we're exposed to. So we're just looking at making sure that everything is below what would be theoretically safe or unsafe levels.
We're talking about disease outbreak and immunizations with Dr. Raj Naik. He's a pediatrician at Gundersen Health System. Dr. Naik, what happens if measles becomes more common again? Do we have ways to treat it?
Well, measles is a viral infection that we have no cure for. We only can treat people supportively or symptomatically. And historically, measles killed about 1 in 2,000 children, so it certainly is a concern. So we would treat them supportively, but we certainly don't have a cure, which is why prevention is so much more important than trying to treat after the fact.
How difficult was it for the country to get rid of measles in the first place?
Yeah, it certainly was a great achievement to nearly have measles eradicated. And it's really a lesson for all of us in terms of continuing to be vigilant with all of our vaccines. And we've shown this historically with other infections as well, is that, you know, if we don't continue to make sure that all of our children are immunized on time and the rates dip, that these diseases can come back.
Looking at measles, looking at vaccine safety with Gundersen Health System pediatrician Raj Naik. You can join in 800-642-1234. What concerns you about vaccinations? What questions do you have about it? We'll be back to this discussion in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about vaccinations here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Nearly every American child contracted measles at some point before the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine was introduced in 1963. And the head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Dr. Robert Redfield, says it's good to talk to older generations to get a reality check on the importance of vaccinations.
The younger parents haven't seen these diseases because we limit them. They don't understand the severity of pertussis, the severity of tetanus, the severity of diphtheria, the severity of polio, the severity of measles.
Grandparents, do you remember measles, mumps, polio, diphtheria, other diseases that have since declined or been mostly eradicated? Do you remember friends or your family members, perhaps yourself, battling them? What was it like to live through that? We're at 800-642-1234. Join in with pediatrician Raj Naik, who stays with us. Let's go back to the phones now with Marta joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Marta.
Hi.
What's on your mind here?
Well, I am a retired healthcare professional. I'm 69 years old, and I had what they thought was a very light case of measles when I was 4 because I had very few spots. It turned out that what I actually had was measles encephalitis, and I have undergone 7 brain surgeries. I've been disabled. I'm unable to work as a nurse or a PA because of memory problems. And I get so angry with parents who don't believe that it's important to get their children immunized. The effects can be devastating. My entire life has been changed because of having measles.
Marta, thank you for bringing your story. Dr. Nike?
Yeah, I really appreciate her bringing forward her personal story, because those stories tend to have a lot of impact on people when you see the devastating effects of these diseases. And it's important to note that for each group of children, something we call a birth cohort that we immunize, we actually save 33,000 lives, about 14 million cases of disease, and billions of dollars in healthcare costs, close to $10 billion in direct healthcare costs and $33 billion in indirect costs. As Marta was demonstrating, she's had lifelong health problems from her case of measles, and we can prevent a lot of that by just making sure that we immunize on time.
Let's go to Tim now, joining us from Sparta. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning. Say, I just wanted to call in. Dr. Nike was actually my oldest son's doctor when he was young, and he would have some adverse reactions to the vaccinations that we would give him periodically. But it was more important to push that vaccination than worry about my son's health at the time. So subsequently with my other children, my middle child has very few vaccinations. We were very selective with those. And my youngest one actually has no vaccinations at this point in time. And my comment, my big thing here is parents need to educate themselves to provide the correct vaccinations, the correct health care for their child specifically. It really depends from child to child, and vaccinations aren't always the right choice for your child.
So
thank you.
Tim is curating the vaccine schedule for each of his children down to his youngest who has no vaccines, Dr. Nike.
Yeah, there's like the caller brought up, there's a lot of parents that have concerns about vaccine safety. And again, I don't know specifically what concerns he had about vaccine safety, but when we look at vaccines as a whole, they're probably the safest thing that we do in medicine because they're so scrutinized. They're scrutinized more than anything else we do. Before vaccines even get licensed, they undergo a lot of studies involving thousands of children. And even after they're licensed, they're studied in tens of thousands of children. And then after that, they're followed in what we call a passive system, which means anybody can report anything so we can find rare side effects that could be related to vaccines. No other interventions in medicine have all of these tracking and safety systems in place to ensure the safety. And despite all of that, the science shows us that the likelihood of a severe vaccine reaction or a severe problem with vaccines is more rare than being struck by lightning. So despite the caller's concerns, and I don't know exactly what his safety concerns were, they really are safe. Minor side effects, sometimes some discomfort or short-term fever or other thing, those are common, but those are short-term compared to our previous caller and her lifelong troubles with measles.
Let's go to Laura now in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Laura.
Hello, good morning. I have to admit that when I was a kid, I had chicken pox. And it wasn't that big of a deal. We all went around, and it was like a chicken pox party to make sure we all got it.
Yes.
So when I became a mom and there was this varicella vaccine, I thought, why? Why do we need all of these vaccines for our kids? I got it for my first son. And then I don't question it anymore is kind of what I want to say. my second son died from the effects of whooping cough when he was 5 weeks old. He'd already spent 11 days in the hospital. He was too young for the immunization. And I really think that a lot of the hesitancy happens because so few of us today who are parents have ever seen what these vaccine preventable diseases actually do to our children. We kind of grew up in this, this fantastic world where we never had to see measles. We never had to see whooping cough. And now because we're refusing the vaccines for our children, parents are seeing them back again.
Laura,
thank you for your time.
Yeah, Laura, thank you for telling your story, and so sorry for your loss, Dr. Nike.
Yeah, I really appreciate your call, and certainly we have a lot of empathy for her and her family. And this is, again, a real-time, real-life story about the devastating effects of the vaccine. And here's a baby that wasn't yet eligible for the vaccine who suffered from, again, something that's potentially vaccine preventable if we all try to do the right thing. And like I said, you know, the science is pretty incontrovertible in terms of the benefits and what we're doing. And it's an interesting phenomenon in that the vaccine program is so successful that when we eradicate or nearly eradicate some of these diseases, people just don't know the devastating effects of these infections and what they can do. And so people become more concerned about theoretical safety issues when what they really should be fearful of is the effects of these devastating diseases.
We only have a few moments left with you, but Gunderson just received this grant from the American Academy of Pediatrics to improve vaccination rates among young children. What do you hope to achieve very quickly?
Yes, as quick as I can. We're really looking at a number of areas to overcome all of the barriers that we discussed earlier, including training healthcare providers on best practices and overcoming vaccine hesitancy, as well as promoting comfort for vaccines, strategies to decrease missed opportunities to vaccinate, working on tools to overcome vaccine hesitancy, and then making sure we have good data and quality improvement processes, and then targeting training to those who need it the most.
Dr. Nike, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Dr. Raj Nike is a pediatrician. He's the childhood immunization champion at Gunderson Health System, and he's on the board for the Wisconsin chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Just ahead, state lawmakers debate Medicaid expansion and presidential candidates give their solutions to healthcare problems. We'll hear two perspectives about what we should do next when it comes to the healthcare debate. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.